The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
It was a Sunday morning in Colorado. A jogger ran alongside the scenic Clear Creek. He was probably thinking about the week ahead, using his time while he jogged to prioritize and think about the things that he needed to do. He never thought a simple jog would result in him calling the police. You see, as he was running, he almost tripped over something, and when he looked down, he couldn't believe what he saw. On the ground before him, there lay a heap of mangled metal. At least, that is what it would look like to most people at first. And when he looked closer, he discovered this crumpled up pile of metal was actually a car, or what used to be a car.
A car? How do you trip over a car?
So this car had been wrecked, and it was lying on the ground, and it wasn't standing up like how you would imagine most cars. Also, the broken vehicle didn't have any windows, and the jogger couldn't even tell who the butchered car belonged to, because there was no license plate. If someone were to describe it, he or she might say it looked like a huge mass of junked metal with four wheels attached to it. There was no way anyone could drive this thing.
Honestly, it kind of sounds like one of my first cars.
Well, I don't think anyone would want to drive this car, and I don't know if there was even a safe way to get into the car. Now, there was two things the jogger did know. The car resembled the remains of a Volkswagen, and he needed to call the police. Remember, it's 1983, Americans had no cell phones, and so he couldn't dial 911. So the closest agency near him was a fire department, and that is where the jogger went to notify people that he had stumbled on a car. He didn't know if the car was the result of a wreck. For all he knew, someone may have decided to get rid of the VW and dump it into the creek.
Well, that would be the smart thing to do, but I'd hope he at least looked into the car, because I'd be curious if there were any survivors if it were a wreck.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. So when fire officials notified the police discovered the VW belonged to a Dr. Perry Nelson, the same Dr. Nelson who we talked about in the last episode.
Oh, that Dr. Nelson. Well, if you remember right, Dr. Nelson wasn't doing so good at the end of the last episode. The last we heard of him, he was swept away by the creek.
Yeah, and that creek, if you remember, it was thrashing that night because it was storming so bad. And, well, this is the last time we'll ever hear about Dr. Nelson being alive because of his friend, Gary Starr Adams, murdered him. So everyone, Ricky and I are back with the second part of our deep dive into the Black Widow murders. This episode is titled The Roaming Heart, Part 2. So if you haven't listened to Part 1 yet, be sure to listen to Part 1 so you don't get any spoilers. And we're ready to get into more of the grisly details about how Sharon Fuller Nelson Harrelson, the Black Widow from our last episode, spun her deadly web.
Ooh, I like that.
Now, please be warned, this narration does include graphic depictions of violence. And if these type of details upset you, please do not listen.
I mean, honestly, I'm excited to learn more about the story. I mean, the last bit was fantastic.
Yeah, and we ended the last episode with Gary watching his supposed friend drift to his death. This had been Gary's second attempt to kill Dr. Nelson, the husband of the woman with whom he'd been having an affair. That woman was Sharon. Some call her Cher. It was also Sharon's idea to murder her husband.
What's crazy to me is these two were in cahoots. Like, why would Gary kill for Sharon? Honestly, like, did he love her that much?
Yeah, and you think about it, he also had a wife and kids at their house.
Yeah, I mean, he threw it all away for her. Like, what type of spell did she have on these guys?
He was definitely under Sharon's spell. He would do whatever he could to keep being with Sharon. And he would later say that the sex with her was like nothing he ever had before. And as our podcast will show, he would go on to murder again. He would do this all again for Sharon. Now let's pick up from where we left the story during the first episode. So after Gary watched the creek's current sweep Harry away to his death, Gary knew he had to make it look like the doctor's car had been in a wreck. If police found the VW with no damage, they would think there was something dubious about Dr. Nelson's disappearance, and they would have to investigate the case more. Now, Gary, he was bleeding from the blows he had sustained from Perry. He was wet, and there was probably mud all over him. But he walked up to the side of the road where the VW was parked. He got behind the wheel. Then he drove it a half a mile away from the spot where he murdered the good doctor. He sped the car up to about 20 miles per hour, swung the door open, and rolled onto the street. The car kept driving. It hit a guardrail and dropped down into the creek. What's worse, the VW's headlights were still on, and the dang vehicle was still floating.
Yikes. I mean, for a murderer, that's not a good sign. For one, it would be easier for someone to see the car. Then it would be easier for someone to locate the car and possibly Perry. I mean, Perry honestly could still be alive at this point,
yeah.
Or unconscious at least.
Yeah, exactly. And at this point, Gary, he was about to panic. He wasn't sure what he should do. So he waited for a few minutes and he sighed a breath of relief. The creek twisted and the VW went around the bend and disappeared. Now, the original plan had been for Gary to knock Perry unconscious, hold him underwater until he drowned, drag his body up to the bank and to the car, put his body in the car, and then drive him and the car off the edge. He thought that there might be a slim chance that Perry made it, but he doubted it. And he was right. Perry did not survive. That made him happy. He didn't want to disappoint Sharon. Now let's go back to the day following the night Gary murdered Perry. It would be Friday, July 23rd, 1988. Dr. Bob Goodhead, who was a good friend of Dr. Perry Nelson, was driving with his wife, Miss Donna Goodhead, to see Perry. It was not an unplanned visit. Both men were optometrists, and they had planned to take courses that the Mountain States Congress of Optometry offered. This nonprofit actually still exists today and is located in Parker, Colorado. The nonprofit focuses on promoting eye care, and they also have an annual convention, which was going on at the same time that Perry was going to take his class. Perry wasn't going to the conference. He just wanted to take a class which would certify him to prescribe medicine.
So was Dr. Goodhead taking the same class?
I don't think he was taking the same class. However, he was going to be at the conference. Knowing that Perry wasn't going to be at the conference, they planned to visit with one another before and after the conference.
I wonder what they thought when they didn't find Dr. Nelson at home.
Right? So they were actually worried because Perry knew his friends were coming. They were expecting him to visit for a while. So there really wasn't any excuse for him to not be there. Like, this all was planned. And as they drove up the driveway, they noticed a new Jeep Eagle that was parked along the way. Donna couldn't understand how Perry and his wife could afford a new car or a new house. Sharon had begged her husband to build her the Roundhouse, the name she had given their home, because it was a circular building. Now, Donna, she also didn't understand all this because she and her husband had already purchased 32 acres of land from the Nelsons to bail them out of some financial issues the Nelsons had been facing. Actually, that's another reason why the Goodheads had driven up to visit the Nelsons. They wanted to check out the land again. Dr. Goodhead wanted to build a cabin on the land so he could retire. But instead of finding Dr. Nelson home, they found Sharon in the doorway. She told them, "Perry is really looking forward to seeing you guys." Then Sharon invited them into the house to wait. Donna was not very pleased about this change in plans.
I'm guessing she wasn't Sharon's biggest fan, though.
Not at all. She didn't like Sharon's behavior. She also probably blamed Sharon for ruining Perry's marriage. Before Sharon came into the doctor's life, he had been married to his high school sweetheart, Julie, and they had three daughters, Tammy, Kathy, and Lori. She also thought Sharon was a big flirt. Donna had a difficult time respecting Sharon. The only reason she ever talked to Sharon is because her husband was friends with Dr. Nelson. And if they weren't, she wouldn't have anything to do with this woman. And when Donna saw Sharon that day, she probably didn't approve of her appearance either. Before, Sharon didn't wear a lot of makeup. She usually wore mascara with lip gloss brushed over cherry chapstick. Well, that day, makeup was all over her face, but in a seductive way. Her top was very low, making it easy for onlookers to catch a glimpse of her breast. And she was wearing her usual shorts.
Do you think Donna was threatened by Sharon? Like she'd go after her husband or something?
That's a possible thing. I mean, she kind of has a thing for people's husbands.
Right.
Now, luckily, Donna knew that her husband wouldn't fall for any of Sharon's passes. He was not a fan of her either, and he only interacted with her because he was friends with Perry. Now, that day, when the Goodheads entered the Nelson home, Sharon began with her go-to conversation starter. She began talking about sex. "Perry and I had the best sex, the most wonderful sex, the night before he left."
I mean, what type of conversation starter is that? It's almost like she's advertising.
Yeah, the only kind that Sharon would actually use. They continued to talk, but the Goodheads kept wondering, what happened to Perry? They did not want to spend their entire day talking to this sexaholic wife. And as the seconds ticked by, the couple began to worry more and more about their friend. They also couldn't comprehend why Sharon wasn't as concerned as they were about Perry's whereabouts. She was his wife, after all. Perry was her husband and the father of their two children, Danny and Misty.
I mean, I'd be worried if you were gone all night.
Yeah, and I would be worried if you were gone all night, thinking something may have happened. But remember, the Roundhouse didn't have any phone lines at the time, so it wasn't surprising that Dr. Nelson hadn't called, but it was surprising that he was not there when his friends arrived. After a bit of time, Mr. Goodhead finally asked about Perry. "Wonder what's keeping him," he said. Sharon replied like she didn't have a care in the world. "He'll be home soon enough," she said. Then she turned on the TV to watch the weather report. The Goodheads kept thinking her behavior was too bizarre.
I mean, it is strange that she's acting weird like that. Wouldn't she be worried about where he is? It kind of makes you feel like she could be connected to his disappearance.
Yeah, and a lot of people were actually thinking that same thing. Like, this was a red flag. Sharon is also manipulative. She had turned on the TV for a reason. When the weather report announced that there was a heavy storm in the Denver area, she used that as an excuse of Dr. Nelson being late. She thought the storm may have caused heavy traffic or maybe he got into a car accident. Then it got stranger. You would never think that a worried wife would say the following. Sharon, as a part of the ongoing afternoon conversation, said, "Bob, I don't believe you'll ever see your friend again."
What? Why would she say that? What? How would she even know that?
Right. And Bob couldn't believe what Sharon had said about his friend either. "What do you mean?" he asked. Donna was silent, too. And Sharon responded, "It's just a feeling. I don't know."
just a feeling. I can't even believe she said that. It's only bringing attention to herself, right? I mean, it takes guts to say something like that.
Like, she knows her husband's dead and has this strange feeling. And what's weird is she's not even, like, showing any sadness about it or anything. She's just like, well, he's probably dead.
Yeah, if I had to take a guess, he probably drowned.
He's probably dead now, and, you know.
Maybe we'll find his car, but I don't know.
They knew something was up, but they just couldn't prove it. Now, that late afternoon, the conversation took an even more awkward turn. Sharon turned to Donna and asked her, what would you do if your husband didn't come home one day? It was an absurd question to even ask. And Donna replied, Bob wouldn't leave. Sharon wouldn't take that for an answer. She persisted. But what if he did? Again, Donna repeated what she had said. That could never happen. But Sharon just kept going. At the end, Donna said, I'd go on and make a life for my children. And that didn't satisfy Sharon.
I mean, how could that not satisfy a person? It seemed like the right answer to me.
It's like she was fishing for the right answer.
Yeah.
Sharon, she was off the rocker. She asked yet again, well, what would you do if Bob just disappeared? Donna was tired of Sharon asking her the same question repeatedly. She said her answer clearly, and she pronounced every word so that Sharon wouldn't have to ask her again. I'd keep living and make my life as good as I could for my children.
Honestly, it just seems like Sharon wanted approval, right? To like go on with her life and move on.
Yeah, I think that too. Now, after this unusual line of questioning, Donna whispered to her husband, let's get the hell out of here. And that's what they did. They went to their motel room in Trinidad, still worried about one of their oldest and dearest friends.
I'd be worried too. It's such like a weird thing, you know, something they all experienced, and it's just a bad vibe. Like, to me, it would just be playing over and over in my head. Like, I wouldn't be able to get it out of my head.
Yeah, like, why would she be asking those questions?
Right.
And why is she saying, oh, you'll probably never see your friend again?
Yeah, exactly.
So the next day on Saturday, like the good friends they were, the Goodheads returned to the roundhouse to see if Dr. Nelson had returned sometime during that night. And the first question Mr. Goodhead asked was, where's Perry, when he saw Sharon? Innocent Sharon responded, he hasn't made it home yet. He'll be home any minute.
Well, I mean, that's what she said the day before, though, right? And to be honest, she's probably just pushing it off as far as she can, like getting the police involved.
Exactly. And Mr. Goodhead, he agreed with what you were saying, Ricky. He figured it was time to go to the police. He knew his friend was in danger or something had happened, and he wouldn't be gone for this long without reaching out to anybody. He told Sharon, something is wrong, Sharon. Let's go call the Denver Tech Center.
Yeah, finally they're doing something though.
Right. So four of them, Sharon, Mr. and Mrs. Goodhead, and Harry Russell, who was there that morning too, went down to the mill to use the phone. Russell had been there because, according to Sharon, Perry had promised him that he would help with the brake lines for his old truck. Since Perry wasn't there, she was helping him instead. And can you guess what was going on between them two?
Probably.
What?
Sex.
Later on, people would discover Sharon had an affair with Harry Russell, too. Now, if you remember, there's no phone at the roundhouse. However, even if there was no phone, Sharon could have easily walked down to the mill herself to call the tech center to see if they had heard anything about Dr. Nelson. And that's when Mr. Goodhead told the Black Widow, call the highway patrol.
I'm telling you, she's waiting as long as she can to get the police involved. Because honestly, the longer you wait, the less evidence there's going to be. And the fact that it was even raining, you know, it's going to wash away evidence.
Yeah, time is of the essence.
She's not stupid.
No. She got off the phone with the highway patrol with no new news. During the previous two nights, there were no records of any car accidents involving a black VW. Wanting to find out what could have happened to Perry, Bob and Donna Goodhead gave Sharon their AT&T telephone credit card so that she can continue to make the calls she needed to from a payphone. The goal was to call everyone they knew to see if someone had any idea about what happened to the good doctor.
And honestly, they're not going to find anything out because the person that they need to talk to is Sharon.
Yeah, or possibly Gary.
Or Gary, yeah.
Now, by dinner time that day, it was the second day since Perry's disappearance. There was no new news. The Goodheads, they couldn't stay any longer. They had to leave. And as they drove, Bob said to Donna, "Something isn't right here. Sharon knows something. I've got a funny feeling about this. She knows more than she's letting on."
Honestly, the Goodheads have a good head on their shoulder. No, but honestly, they have great instincts because they were on to her the whole time, I think.
Yeah. The next morning is when people realized something was very wrong. This was the same day the jogger had come across the deformed remains of the black VW. After that, the Trinidad police asked for Sharon to go to the police department. She needed to file a missing persons report. It was at the station the officer told Sharon that they found the crushed remnants of her husband's VW. So Sharon, she would recall what she said at the police station that day while filling out the missing persons report. She said, "I'm bananas by now," Sharon said. "They," the police, "are saying, calm down, calm down. We can call the doctor to give you something." Sharon said, "How can I calm down? You people don't even know what's going on here. I don't sleep all night. I know I've got patients coming in. I don't know where my husband is. Get my kids to the center. I've got an office full of people waiting."
It's crazy because she's now pretending like she's so concerned about her husband. But at the same time, she didn't even make this about her husband. She made it about herself because she's like, "I have all these patients and we need to find someone to watch my kids because I have so much to do." It almost turned to be about her.
Yeah, there's a lot of I statements like, "I'm bananas. I can't sleep. I haven't seen my husband. I have patients, my kids."
Exactly.
What about your husband's car? Like, what about him? And she was not the only one who learned about the destroyed VW of Dr. Perry's. Perry's friends were starting to find out what happened too. Dr. Terry Mitchell, from whom Perry rented his office space, is distressed. Dr. Mitchell was also a chiropractor, and often he and Perry would chit-chat during the day. Jim and Julie Whitley, who are friends of Perry and Terry, they were troubled and upset. They want to do what they can to help Sharon, who should be in obvious anguish about whether her husband is dead or alive. That is the question everyone is asking themselves at this point since the jogger found the VW. And it wasn't long before Perry's friends grouped together and formed a search party to try and find Perry. All of them gathered into Dr. Mitchell's van with the hope of finding Perry alive.
You know what's kind of sad? I kind of wish Dr. Nelson knew how many people loved him. Like, even after the affair with Sharon, all of these people cared about him.
Yeah, and there was that moment, if you remember in part one, where he was contemplating suicide.
Exactly.
Now, usually during a search for someone who is missing, most people are focused on finding the missing person, especially the family and friends of the missing person. That's what people expected of Sharon. They figured she was going to concentrate on ways to find her husband. So Mr. Jim Whitley was surprised when he felt someone rub his thigh. He asked himself, what was happening? He thought it was something innocent, like maybe Sharon had accidentally rubbed his leg as they drove along the creek looking for any sign of the alive Dr. Nelson. And Mr. Whitley, he knew the car was crowded like sardines. The touch could have easily happened by mistake. Then it happened again. The woman, whose husband could be in grave danger, was stroking his legs, touching the inner part of his thigh. She was making a pass at him. Mr. Whitley wanted to escape, but there was nowhere to go.
I mean, if I were Mr. Whitley, I'd want to get out of the van too. I mean, this lady has no boundaries whatsoever.
Yeah, and her husband is missing and is in grave danger. They just found his car completely destroyed.
Sharon is nothing but trouble.
She is definitely trouble. Any man within a mile of this woman should run away.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer.
Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
In the van, Mr. Whitley thought to himself, "Good God, what is this woman doing? My wife's sitting right behind us. Her husband is missing in the creek, and she's groping me." But she wasn't worried. She wasn't crying. And so when they got out of the car, Mr. Whitley's priority was to get away from this woman. He did not want to get caught in the Black Widow's spider web.
Smart guy.
100%. They kept the search going through the night. They got a motel outside of Denver. And while most of the searchers thought Sharon would be sobbing, she didn't seem as tearful as some of the other searchers. Instead, she complained about being hungry and tired, and she said she only wanted to sleep. The searchers thought each person has his or her own way to grieve. That night of the search, Sharon slept in the same room as the Mitchells, and they claimed that the Black Widow slept like a baby.
Well, it doesn't really seem like the Black Widow has a guilty conscience.
She didn't have a worry in the world. And the following morning, the searchers stopped by the Trinidad Sheriff's Department. No new news. They tried the fire department. There was no news there either. They also went to the dump yard to look at the folded up black VW. Sharon stayed in the van while the rest of the searchers evaluated the car. And Dr. Mitchell told his wife when he saw the car, he said, "It looks like it's been through a damn meat grinder." Still, even though the car was mangled, Dr. Mitchell could tell the piece of car junk used to be his friend's black VW. Emergency rescuers had told the group that nothing found in the car gave any hint of what happened to Dr. Nelson. The only items they found in the car was a sleeping bag that managed to get hooked to the passenger side of the mirror, causing it to dangle in the water.
A sleeping bag. I kind of remember that from the last episode. So Dr. Nelson had parked his car beside the road that night because they were getting ready for bed or whatever. And then he, I think, moved the seats back or something like that and laid down a sleeping bag so that they could sleep.
Yeah, for his friend Gary, so that he could sleep comfortably in the car.
I mean, honestly, that was pretty nice of him.
Yeah, that was really nice of him. One of the patrol officers was nice, too. When he saw the group of searchers, his heart must have gone out to them. They took the searchers to the place where they believed the car had met its terrible demise. At that spot, there was a twisted guardrail, and bits of black paint could be found on the rail. The patrol officer said the driver must have been driving more than 80 miles per hour for the guardrail to have sustained that damage. Now, the searchers, they continued looking for Dr. Nelson. There was a Coors plant nearby that had constructed a big screen in the creek to keep any type of large waste from contaminating the water. And they looked, and they didn't find anything. They went 2 miles from the screen up the creek, and they still did not find a human body, dead or alive. They did, however, find different items that must have once been in the black VW. Maps, bedding, and other types of items. These items did prove that it was Dr. Nelson's VW that took a raging trip down a stormy river.
And they found all of those items, but still no body.
No body. The Mitchells thought Dr. Nelson may still be alive. Maybe he had amnesia and couldn't remember what happened or his family. Although they would never admit their thoughts to Sharon, Dr. Nelson could have faked his death to create a new life for himself. The Mitchells wouldn't blame him. His wife was evil. They thought it might be a good idea to bring photographs of Dr. Nelson to bus stations, the airport, or maybe even cab companies. Maybe people there saw him alive. But Sharon didn't want to do that. Secretly, she knew that would be useless. To the searchers, she said, "I don't think so. I think he's gone for good." And the searchers didn't understand why she wouldn't even consider that Dr. Nelson might still be alive.
Well, what's crazy is that the searchers, they want to do more work than his actual wife.
Yeah, she's sitting in the van as they're looking over the damaged vehicle.
Right. I mean, this is the woman who should be suffering the most out of anybody.
Exactly. Now, other people may have kept searching. Sharon did go out once more. Instead, however, she focused on getting her things together. She asked to stay with the Whitleys because she wanted to be closer to the police station in case any of the officers heard any news about the doctor. She also wanted to take care of the doctor's optometry office and buy business. Now, Mr. Whitley, he allowed her to stay, but he made sure to keep his distance from this woman. He didn't want a repeat of what happened in the van. And the next morning, Sharon got right down to business. No one had found Dr. Nelson's body, and Sharon was already selling his things.
Selling his things? Like what? Like his clothes, electronics, like stuff from the doctor's office? Like what?
Well, possibly that, but she had her eye set on valuable items. First, she started by selling Perry's guns. Mr. Whitley had been impressed by the guns Sharon had mentioned that were in the doctor's collection, and Sharon offered the weapon to him immediately, not caring that this gun could have held some kind of emotional value to her husband. "You can pay me later," Sharon told Mr. Whitley. But Mr. Whitley couldn't do that. He was not going to immediately buy some of his friend's valuables. No one even knew what happened to Dr. Nelson. Mr. Whitley even told Sharon about Perry. He could still be alive. Sharon didn't think that was possible.
Well, she knew it wasn't possible.
Well, he must have been laying low for a while because he didn't want to raise any red flags, and maybe he didn't want the police thinking that he had anything to do with the murder. And it's funny that you bring him up because the following day, Mr. Adams made an appearance at the Whitley residence. Sharon introduced Mr. Adams as Perry's good friend, and she explained to the Whitleys that Mr. Adams was going to help her sell Dr. Nelson's guns. Then, Gary Adams started making appearances during the following week while Sharon was staying with the Whitleys. Mr. Whitley figured there was something up between the two. Mr. Whitley also told his wife that he thought at one point Sharon and Gary were lovers. He also told his wife something didn't feel right. Something from the very start didn't feel right about those two. It wasn't Gary. I liked Gary. He was decent. It was Sharon who gave me the creepy feeling.
It's kind of strange he didn't get any weird vibes from Gary.
Yeah, it really is because, I mean, he's the one who murdered him. And you would think that with these two having some kind of relationship going on, it would send a red flag. But at the same time, people, they still didn't know Gary very well. They had already been introduced to Sharon, and they knew that she was a manipulative woman who planned her every move. But as for Gary, they didn't really know much. She was very calculating. No one had yet found his body, and Sharon, who was already selling his gun collection, was putting his optometry practice up for sale. She gave an excuse for why she moved so quickly with the sale. She said, "The reason I put the practice up for sale so soon is it took over 2 years to find a buyer for the other office in Rocky Ford. And I knew also that a practice without a doctor doesn't sell very well, and I wanted his practice to continue with a new doctor. According to the president of Colorado Optometric Association, the sooner a practice is listed after death, the better chance a doctor will be willing to take it over. That's why."
I can give you the real reason.
What's that?
She wanted that money.
Yeah, that's probably more accurate. Then, when Sharon returned to the roundhouse, Gary moved in with her. If people didn't suspect her before then, they definitely suspect her after Gary made the roundhouse his home too. People also wondered if the doctor was still alive. What would happen if he was still alive and he walked into his home to find a close friend living with his wife? And if he was dead, well, where is his body? There were multiple searches, and at one point, a plane with infrared equipment flew over the location where the car fell into the creek, but there was no trace of Dr. Nelson. 3 weeks after the first search, there was another big search. This was the only other search that Sharon attended, and she and Gary were the ones leading the search.
Well, that's nice. So you have the murderer leading the search, And obviously, he's just going to lead you into the places that he knows he isn't.
Yeah. And not only that, most of the people in the group were somber. Their hearts were in pain for the doctor, Sharon, and their children. These children were more than likely going to be raised without their father. Sharon, though, she wasn't really upset at all. She was actually happy. She was shacked up with her lover and having the time of her life. Some of the searchers said it seemed like the two were actually on a date. At home, Sharon took this opportunity to mold Gary into the perfect man. She convinced him to use hairspray, a hair product he had never used in his mind. She blow-dried his hair, provided him with lotion bottles for his skin, and she also bought him a new wardrobe, including skin-tight pants. And Sharon loved this new look for Gary.
Gary seemed to be totally infatuated with Sharon. Like, completely whipped, he would do anything for her.
He would do absolutely anything. And in bed is where Sharon and Gary had their best times. However, outside of the bed, the arguments would start. Sharon thought sex would be the solution. Gary would later say that Sharon, at times, she would use sex as a peacemaker. If she thought I was really mad, she'd come in with all of this charm, turn it off and on like a water faucet. And other times, she could be as cold as ice towards me. Gary also complained about Sharon's work ethic. Sharon only wanted to have fun and play, and he would tell Sharon, you must think ahead. You can't just play all the time. You gotta work at times. But Sharon didn't seem to listen to him. After 2 months, he left Sharon and returned to his wife, Nancy. He told her he loved her, but he loved Nancy too, and they had a son together. And Nancy was willing to give him a second chance. Thus continued the on-again and off-again relationship between Sharon and Gary. But when Gary said that he was leaving, Sharon didn't resist. She could get sex anywhere she needed, anywhere else. And she told Gary she was moving in with Buzz, another man Sharon had an affair with when Dr. Nelson was still alive. But that didn't keep the two of them away from one another. Whenever Sharon got tired of Buzz or didn't have another man to run to, she would go to Gary, and Gary accepted her with open arms. There was also one time when Gary separated from his wife. He told Nancy to take their son to Denver and get a job. And Nancy, she was tired of staying in a marriage where her husband consistently cheated on her. She was more than glad to leave. But even the separation with his wife wasn't permanent. Gary loved both women. He had like a ping pong ball bouncing from one woman to the other.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to be like a fun position to be in.
Yeah, not at all. Then August 14th of 1984, something happened. Someone found a body. It was about 13 months after Gary killed Nelson at the creek. Gary was driving, and there was a sheriff coming from the opposite direction. When he saw Gary driving, he quickly made a U-turn, and he turned on the sirens. Gary stopped at the side of the road. He got out, preparing to tell the officer that he hadn't been speeding. Instead, the deputy told Gary he needed to talk to Sharon, who was in the passenger seat.
Wait, were they going to arrest Sharon?
No. Instead, Gary went to the car and told Sharon the officer was actually wanting to talk to her. Sharon got outside of the car, and as gently as possible, the officer told her that they had made a discovery up north. When Sharon returned to the car, she told Gary, they found Perry's body in the creek along a sandbar.
Jeez. So after a full year of searching, infrared airplanes, all of that, they finally find the body.
Yes.
Wow. At least it's closure for the family. They at least know what happened.
Yeah. Well, Sharon, she already had the closure that she needed because she knew what happened. While it had taken more than a year to find the body, the Clear Creek waters had kept Perry's corpse preserved. And the corpse was also wearing the same clothing that Sharon had described to the police. So there was actually no question that the body found was Perry's body.
So did Sharon identify the body?
Well, that's the curious part. So when Terry Mitchell heard Perry's corpse had been found, something about the body's description didn't jive. The description read that the corpse looked like the body of a 30-year-old. Well, Perry was 50 years old. Terry wondered, how could that be the same body? He wanted to go and see the dead body for himself. It would be easy for Terry to do so because he didn't live that far away from the Jefferson County Coroner's Office. So he called the coroner's office and he told the receptionist, I'd like to come in and view the body of the man pulled from Clear Creek. He supposedly is a friend of mine. And the receptionist told him he couldn't identify the body. She told him identifying the body was not a part of proper procedure, and Dr. Mitchell would have to call back on Monday when the coroner was in the office.
Well, that sucks. I mean, that kind of delays everything then.
Yeah, and Terry, he was discouraged about it, but he agreed and he called back on Monday. So first thing Monday morning, this time a clerk answered, and the clerk said, sorry, doctor. Dr. Nelson's remains were sent to the crematorium this morning. His wife is having the remains sent to Michigan for burial. So Perry, he's originally from Michigan and his parents, they live there. And Terry didn't get a chance to identify the body. So he's now just thinking like, was that even Perry's body?
Well, who identified the body then?
Actually, no one identified the body. According to the clerk, he was identified through Perry's dental records.
It's weird.
And there was just too many questions around this time. Like, why were they so quick to cremate the body? Why couldn't they let a person identify the body? Why did they just have to use just dental records? And also, the timing of the cremation was odd, too.
I don't know. I guess I just don't understand. I get that they use dental records, but why wouldn't you also identify the body? That just seems like something that you would do.
Yeah, because his body was preserved. It wasn't like he was completely destroyed from the car accident.
You know? And there's people who live around there. It's not like there was no friends or family. They could have easily came down to identify the body.
Right. Now, only a few days before, an insurance adjuster, a very smart insurance adjuster, if I may add, had called up Mr. Mitchell asking if he could talk to him. Because he had this theory that Sharon and Gary may have been working together to kill Dr. Nelson, and he wanted to find out more information about Mrs. Nelson and her lover. From the point that Dr. Nelson disappeared, Sharon hadn't received all of her life insurance proceeds because there was no body to prove that Perry was actually dead. With the body found, the insurance adjuster called Dr. Mitchell back to let him know that he no longer needed to meet with him. Mrs. Nelson was getting all of the money. But how odd is that? There's a body, no visual identification, only dental identification, then cremation, then Sharon gets the money that she's been coveting.
I don't know. It does seem weird. It almost makes you wonder if something strange was going on behind the scenes. Like, was this even Dr. Perry?
Right. Like, was something planted there or dental records? I don't know. Something seems like something was messed with.
Yeah, strange.
Now, Terry Mitchell has always doubted the body's identification. He would later say, I saw what that river did to that Volkswagen. It had been crushed to barely 2 feet tall. It had been beat up so bad that you could barely tell it was a car at all. What would a year in that river do to a human body? There would be nothing left. No socks on the man's feet. A shirt? That water rushed through there 45 miles an hour. It would rip the arms off a man. If it was Perry, I don't think that he was in there for that long.
I mean, I don't fully understand like the science of all of it, but a year in the water, you would think the body would be completely bloated. Fish might have been eating off of the body. Like, it's very strange that they're saying, oh, it was very well preserved and he almost looked like a 30-year-old when he was actually 50. It's just, I don't know, red flags.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. Now, Terry, he did make a few good points, and he also came up with his own theory. He thought that Perry may have been the victim of double cross, that Perry returned to get his share of the money, and Sharon and Gary didn't want to give him his share that they promised him. And to keep him quiet, they hit him on the head and threw his body in the river. That would explain why his body was so well preserved. But what makes this even more suspicious? The clerk who talked to Dr. Mitchell said that the body had been identified with dental records, But if you remember Barb, the receptionist who used to work in one of Dr. Nelson's offices, she said that she had run into Sharon after she had made identification of Perry's body. Barb had asked the Black Widow if she was sure the body found was Perry's body. And Sharon's response? Yes, Barb, I am. I'd know that long-legged bastard anywhere.
Well, that's a weird way to describe him. But what's weird to me, if that story's true, then the clerk would have been wrong. So what she's saying is that there were two identifications made. One made by Sharon and one by the dental records. So did Sharon actually see the body and identify him?
It's really hard to believe Sharon at this point or what really happened because, for one, no one trusted her. And on top of that, she never held a memorial service for Dr. Nelson. So it's like, what was she trying to hide? Did she really identify the body or is she just saying, yeah, I identified it, you know? And she told people that she just can't deal with the trauma of losing him all over again. And that's the reason why she didn't have a memorial service. And 3 days after the body was found, Sharon brought his cremated remains in a box into the roundhouse.
Honestly, that's pretty messed up. I mean, it's not her decision to withhold that from the family. I mean, the family needs a chance to grieve.
Yeah, and she didn't care at all that not having a memorial would hurt the rest of Dr. Nelson's family, specifically his parents and his three daughters from his first marriage. And so after the cremation, the insurance money came rolling in. The total cost of all of the death benefits totaled more than $250,000. Gary and Sharon would agree that they would split the benefits in thirds. So Sharon would have a third, Gary would have a third, and then a third would be saved for the kids, Misty and Danny. And at the time, Gary and Sharon, who were well known for their tumultuous relationship, believed they would live happily ever after.
And I'm assuming that didn't happen.
That never happened. One of the most heated arguments was Sharon's spending. She spent a lot of money, and not just on herself, but on her family too. She purchased toys and clothes for her children. She bought Gary a motorcycle. She spent hundreds on a blue fox and mink coat. And Gary wanted her to slow her spending. He told her that continued spending would raise red flags. And Gary said, I tried to tell Sharon she needed to spend the money wisely, but she'd go and have her fingernails done, have a little gold things put on them. It cost $50. I tried to explain to her that $50 maybe doesn't seem like much when you've got all this money, but years down the road, it could buy a lot of food. And she may have stopped spending for a little bit, but then she would go right back to her outrageous habits. Other people began to notice too. One of those people included Barb, the receptionist. And remember, it was due to Sharon that she never received her unemployment benefits. Sharon had purposely stopped paying those fees so the government couldn't pay out Barb's unemployment benefits when Dr. Nelson had let her go. And Barb observed Sharon's spending, and she would say, let me tell you all the stuff she bought. She bought a new Bronco, she bought a fur, she bought a mink coat. But you add it all up, the other things that she bought for other people, then Barb would sigh and say of Sharon, she spent it all. She spent it all.
Well, I guess she now has everything that she wants.
Right? What else could she want? She had all the money that she could spend. But she didn't have everything she wanted. She wanted Gary all to herself. If it was up to her, she would have Gary divorce Nancy and marry him. She didn't know why Gary couldn't give up his relationship with Nancy. Gary, he knew this, but he kept stalling. As much as he loved Sharon, he didn't want to get into a relationship with her. He told her, if we get married, Cher, you'll lose your Social Security. That's $400 a month you'll lose. It's not worth it. We can live together. Why don't we just keep pretending we're married?
It's almost like he's starting to see her true colors.
Yeah, I would think so. All right, it's time to get honest. Getting a good night's sleep can feel impossible sometimes, whether you're too hot, too cold, or just can't get comfortable. I know for me, sometimes I felt myself rotating like a rotisserie chicken. And if you're having this problem, it's time to upgrade your sheets with Miracle Made sheets. Inspired by NASA technology, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics that are designed to regulate your temperature so you can sleep perfectly cozy all night long. Traditional sheets can trap bacteria, but Miracle-Made sheets are infused with silver, preventing up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. That means they stay cleaner and fresher 3 times longer. So say goodbye to gross odors and constant laundry. And thanks to NASA-inspired silver-infused fabrics, these sheets naturally adjust to keep you at the perfect temperature, whether it's a chilly fall night or a warm summer evening. No more tossing and turning. And your old sheets could be causing breakouts because the bacteria building up can clog pores. But Miracle-Made sheets help you sleep clean and clear by keeping bacteria away from your skin. And what I love most about Miracle-Made sheets, they feel so soft and luxurious, as if I'm sleeping in a 5-star hotel, but without the high price tag. Comfort, quality, and affordability are all in one. Ready to sleep better and feel better? Go to trymiracle.com/crimesalad. That's trymiracle.com/crimesalad to try Miracle-Made sheets today. Order now and you'll save over 40%. Plus, when you use our promo code CRIMESALAD at checkout, you'll get a free 3-piece towel set and save an extra 20%. And the best part, Miracle-Made is so confident that you'll love their sheets that they are offering a 30-day money-back guarantee. Not 100% satisfied? Get a full refund. No questions asked. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle-Made. Visit trymiracle.com/crimesalad and use code CRIMESALAD to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40%. Thank you, Miracle-Made, for sponsoring this episode of Crime Salad. Now, being in some semblance of a relationship with Sharon seemed to be risky for any man. At one point, Sharon was pretending to be engaged to get married to Buzz Reynolds, the man who she went to for sex, when Gary left her to go back to his wife. And Sharon, she invited everyone to a poolside party for their wedding. About 100 people showed up. Meanwhile, no one really knows how the two were married because Sharon was vague about the legal aspect of the ceremony. In reality, she never really married Buzz. She just made a show of it. Then, a little later, Sharon has a conversation with Gary. Buzz needs to have an accident, she told him.
Are you serious? Now she wants to kill Buzz?
Yeah, and she wasn't even married to him. She wanted to try and murder Buzz, too. When Sharon asked her question, Gary had been confused. Accident, he said. Sharon answered, yes, I think he could have an accident real soon. Gary told Sharon that wouldn't be a good idea. He said, Sharon, it's too soon. It's only been a couple years since Perry.
Of course it's too soon. Like, what would she even gain from that?
She just wants to kill a second person, and I don't even know. And she's not even married to him at this point. I'm beginning to think she just likes the thrill of all of this. And Sharon wasn't swayed by Gary's comment, saying it was too soon for the murder. She kept trying. She said to Gary, it'd be real easy. All you have to do is hit him on the head and have him fall in the lake.
Man, she has a thing for death and bodies of water.
It does seem like that. It seems like she thinks that the best way to kill someone is to drown them. But Gary, he didn't think this was a good idea to kill anyone at all. He replied, think, Sharon, here you are married to two people. They're dead and water is connected. And Sharon realized her mountain man, the name a true crime author had given Gary due to his rough appearance as a man who looked like he lived out in the wild, her mountain man may have a point. Using water as a weapon for the second time might not be the best idea. So she thought of another way. She suggested to do the dirty deed when Buzz was out doing his business deliveries. When Buzz drives around in the canyon, you could drive by and shoot him and make it look like a robbery. Gary told her again, it was just too soon. Besides, you two aren't even legally married.
Exactly. They're not even married. So what would she gain out of all of this?
I don't know. It's confusing because Buzz was rich and maybe she thought she could steal some of his stuff. Who knows? But Gary's comment made her forget about Buzz. For a while, Sharon continued her life, having the on-again, off-again relationship with her mountain man. If her mountain man wasn't available for her, she went to Buzz. If those two weren't available, she went to a guy named Russell. One Saturday morning, though, in 1987, Sharon was bored, and Gary was with Nancy for the umpteenth time. She sat back with a cigarette and a cup of coffee as she relaxed. She skimmed through the newspaper when she came across an ad in the personal section. There was no photo. It just included simple conversations. She needed to call the number and give the person who answered her any information needed. Then the operator sent her call to voice messages that had been left by men who were looking for women similar to Sharon.
Well, that doesn't seem good.
Yeah, not a good idea. But Sharon continued listening to the voice messages. One particular voice message sounded interesting. The message was from Glenn Harrelson. Sharon then dialed the number. Harrelson was a Denver firefighter in his 40s who had recently been divorced. He had two children, a son, Todd, who was born in 1969, and a daughter, Tara, who was born in 1971. After the divorce, Glenn became lonely. His wife, Andrea, who married on September 20th, 1963, had been the love of his life. He never expected that they would get a divorce. The two just grew apart. And after 22 years, Andrea told Glenn there was no fixing the marriage. The divorce about killed him. Glenn's best friend, Jim Schindler, remembered what it was like for him when he got a divorce. He said that he was at the absolute bottom of the world. He was very much in love with Andy, and he didn't know what to do to put his marriage back together.
Honestly, though, I feel for him. I mean, no divorce is easy, but his heart had to have been shattered.
Yeah, it was. And a little bit after this divorce, Glenn started seeing a counselor. Although he missed Andrea very much, he knew that he couldn't be with her. So he started to go and explore the dating scene. He joined a singles group at North Glen Christian Church, but the singles group wasn't working because the majority of the members there were young. Some were about half of his age. So he tried advertising in the singles magazine.
Oh, man. And that's how the Black Widow found him.
Yes. Several weeks after putting in the advertisement, Glenn told his friends he found a new woman. Her name is Sharon, but she likes to be called Cher.
Oh, man. This dude is about to go down a painful road. Honestly, if I could tell him, I'd just be like, dude, run away. Get out of there.
And that's what some of his friends told him to do. Just like Dr. Nelson's friends, who were not a fan of Sharon when the two were a couple, Glenn's friends did not like Sharon, and they tried to tell him. One of those friends was Rick Philippe. Rick, who knew Glenn from their church bowling team, had gone out for lunch with Glenn and Sharon at Burger King. And Rick was excited because it was the first time that he would see his friend with a new woman. He wanted the best for his friend because he knew that the divorce had been very rough on him. But during that lunch, Rick realized that Sharon was not right for his friend at all. Glenn deserved better. And it wasn't what she said during this time, it was her actions. Her behavior showed that she wanted Glenn all to herself, and she didn't want anyone else around them, including any of Glenn's friends. Sharon had sat herself in between the two men, and whenever Rick tried to talk to his friend, Sharon would intentionally lean forward to block Rick from becoming involved in the conversation. No matter how many times he tried, Rick couldn't talk to Glenn. He got so annoyed, and so he made up an excuse to leave, saying that he had to get back to work at the car dealership. Rick wasn't the only one who noticed this. Glenn's circle of friends kept getting slimmer and slimmer until the only person who remained was Sharon. Sharon also started snaking her way into every part of Glenn's life. For instance, she began complaining that she didn't like her rental house in Denver. And by this time, she had moved to Denver from the Roundhouse because she wanted a change of scenery. She said her next-door neighbors kept her up all hours of the night because of their dogs barking. And she also told Glenn that she didn't think the house was a good place for Danny and Misty to grow up. So Glenn, who had fallen head over heels in love with the Black Widow, suggested she and the children stay with him in his house. And of course, she said yes. There was no way Sharon would say no to free lodging. So she moved in immediately. She decorated the house her way. She rearranged the furniture. She posted religious verses throughout the home.
Wait, now she's a religious person?
It was all a part of the act, I'm assuming. And even Glenn's daughter thought there was something off about her father's new girlfriend. Tara thought it was odd that Sharon had overtaken her father's home so quickly. But what she thought was even stranger was the name that she found on one of Sharon's business cards. It didn't read Sharon Nelson, which would have made sense since Sharon had been married to Dr. Perry Nelson. Instead, it read Cher Harrelson. As far as Terry knew, she had not heard her father talk of any marriage to Sharon. And she had not attended a wedding for her father and Sharon. And there was just no way her father wouldn't have invited the children to his wedding. And Tara would later say of Sharon and Glenn, "I think she just kind of pushed her way into his life. He just wanted to be loved."
We should rename this episode America's Top Seductress.
We should. Now, Glenn, he was so in love. He told his ex-wife there was a new woman in his life. Even though the two had divorced and they had remained friends, Andrea was delighted her ex-husband had found someone. She also knew if Glenn found someone, the relationship would have to be serious because he was the type of person who wanted to settle down with one person.
But it's sad because Sharon's not the type to settle down.
She's not. Her eyes were always lingering over other men. And it would even happen right in front of him. Glenn may have never noticed Sharon's lingering eyes. He was just too in love. When he would be talking with Andrea, he told her, "There's one problem. She doesn't know if she wants to get married again. She feels like it's bad luck to be married to her, like there's a black cloud hanging over her."
It's almost like that's some type of warning.
Whatever it was, whether it was a warning or she enjoys controlling what people do and what they say, and she pretends that she loves people. But when she's really needed, she just doesn't show up. And this happened when Glenn, he had to go to the hospital. So one night, Sharon was nowhere to be found, and Glenn had to call Andrea for help. "Could you get me and take me to the hospital?" he asked. Andrea had known he had mono for a few days, and she got up, dressed, took Glenn to the hospital. And Sharon, she didn't show up until the following morning.
Now that's true love.
But that wasn't even the most shocking part. So when she finally arrived at the hospital, she found Glenn in bed with IV tubes for hydration, and she told Glenn, in front of Andrea, that she had ran into an old friend, and she was wondering if it would be okay for them to see other people.
Let me guess, the mountain man, Gary.
Gary found his way back into Sharon's life. And his ex-wife, Andrea, who's sitting there in the hospital room, is witnessing this basically one-sided conversation. She thought this question was very cruel, too. I mean, he's in the hospital. He can barely talk. He couldn't even move his lips. Andrea told a friend about this incident. Of course, Glenn wanted the relationship to be exclusive. I guess it was a manipulation to make him hold on tighter. As for Glenn's friends, they thought this was great news. Some even thought, "Ding dong, the Wicked Witch is dead." But their happy days didn't seem to last long. Glenn made an announcement. He and Sharon had gotten back together. They were getting married. And so one of the first things that Glenn and Sharon did after they got engaged, Glenn stopped by the insurance office and he made his soon-to-be wife his beneficiary.
And another fly gets stuck in the web.
Yep. On June 2nd of 1988, Sharon and Glenn made their marriage official. Now, the name claimed to be on the business cards that Tara found were correct. Mrs. Cher Nelson was now Mrs. Cher Harrelson. And the marriage was not a marriage made in heaven. The argument started pretty quickly. One of the first arguments centered around the roundhouse because Sharon told Glenn that there was no way she was giving up her luxurious home. And her excuse? "I will not raise my kids in a city. They will be raised in a small town." Glenn tried to persuade Sharon to stay in Denver. He even suggested they find a house in Castle Rock. Then he would be close to work, and her kids could still have a rural school atmosphere. Sharon disagreed. "I don't want to leave," she said. "If you have a problem with that, mister, then look for someone new. I'm staying put. Because the only way that Sharon would be happy was if she kept her roundhouse and she and Glenn had a commuter relationship.
Well, you know she only wanted that roundhouse so she'd be close to Gary.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like she ever really cared about the kids and where they were growing up or anything like that. She just had, you know, much more important things to worry about and think about.
Yeah, herself.
And so Glenn caved and they were going to have a commuter relationship. Glenn became a consistent resident at the roundhouse, and neighbors began to recognize him as he came and went. And when they met Glenn, they thought he was a very kind and honest man. And there was even other people from the outside looking in, like this guy named Mr. Robinson, who saw through Sharon and thought to himself, my God, is there some way I can warn this guy? Something's telling me that he'd better watch this woman. But Mr. Robinson didn't know how Glenn would react to such a warning, and he thought, well, it's just none of my business. And there were many of Glenn's friends who would tell him to stay away from Sharon. So there were warnings, but it really wasn't his fault at all. He was just under some kind of black widow spell. And instead of listening to them, he ended up marrying her. However, months into this marriage, Glenn thought maybe he made a mistake. He thought he may have rushed into the marriage. He began sensing that Sharon was seeing another man, and, well, she was. It was Gary. And Glenn would bring up his suspicions to Andrea. She would later say he knew that there was a man back in her hometown who bothered her. She made it sound as though his attentions were unwelcome, and Glenn knew about it. But Glenn, he didn't know what to do about it. Andrea was not the only person who Glenn confided in about his wife's cheating. He told his friend Mickey Baker, a young woman who he had met in the church singles group. Though Glenn and Mickey knew their age difference was too big for an intimate and sexual relationship to occur, she said Glenn told her, I know Gary's around. She thinks I'm an idiot, but I'm not stupid. Mickey asked how he knew. He answered, I found some cigarette butts around the mountain house. Cher smokes Bel Air. I smoke Marlboro. And those aren't either one. The ones I found are Gary's brand.
I just wish he would have gone through with the divorce instead of trying to mend things.
Yeah. But if you remember, he just had a divorce after 22 years of marriage. He may have thought he failed his first family and he didn't want to fail again. He wasn't the type to just, like, give up.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't want to give up on that first marriage anyways.
Right.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
And Sharon, she's the complete opposite of that. She's now on her third marriage, this one with Glenn, and she had started cheating again with Gary. Once she was back with Gary, she realized she didn't want to be with anyone else. She had really missed him. She didn't miss the minister. She didn't miss the doctor. She missed Gary. But there was one problem to them being together, her marriage.
Oh, no.
Yep. Glenn was in the way of her happiness. And if you asked Gary, he would tell you he couldn't stay away from Sharon either. He considered her the most desirable woman in the world. And when Sharon realized Gary was the one she wanted, she knew they needed to make another accident occur. So she brought up the idea of an accident possibly happening again.
Honestly, I'm curious of how she even brought this up.
Well, it was a Monday on November 15th of 1988. Sharon and her mountain man, Gary, were cuddling up in bed. They probably just had sex. And she told Gary she wanted to get rid of Glenn. And she gave him a deadline. I want it done before Thanksgiving. She told Gary, Glenn's mother is coming from Des Moines, and I don't want to spend the holiday with her. I can't stand her.
So basically, this would be a good time to get rid of Glenn because she doesn't want to spend time with his mother.
Yeah, it'd be very inconvenient and annoying.
Wow, okay.
She's something, that's all I can say. Now, this time, Gary did not come up with an excuse for why another murder would not be a good idea. I guess enough time had passed from the last murder, which had occurred in 1983. And to make it easier for Gary to carry through with the murder, she sketched a map of the Thornton area where Glenn lived. And this was so he would not have any difficulty finding Glenn's house. And she also gave him pointers, like she was the teacher and he was the student. She advised Gary that he should park in the King Super lot or the Safeway parking lot. The map also included driving directions. Gary had to take I-25 to 120th Avenue, then head to Claude Court. She had only one request. She wanted Gary to bring her back proof of his kill. She wanted him to bring back to her Glenn's wedding ring. And she told Gary where to find it. "The last time I saw it was on top of the dresser," she said. And if it's not there, she told him to look through Glenn's jeans watch pocket.
I don't really understand what the wedding ring proves.
I don't really either, but to Sharon, maybe this was just like confirmation that Gary had completed the job.
Yeah, but couldn't he just steal it and bring it to her?
Whatever the point is, he just wanted to keep seeing her, and the Black Widow had a spell over him. Now, this conversation that Sharon and Gary had in bed while figuring out how to get rid of Glenn is what police officials believe what happened. Sharon would later provide a different narrative. She said the plan to kill her third husband was Gary's idea. She said she never wanted anyone dead, and it was Gary who was the one pressuring her to kill Glenn. Glenn was the one asking her for the key to the house at the Columbine Court. Gary was the one who pestered her to draw a map of the area for him. She said he just kept hounding her, and she couldn't say no to him. Finally, she just yelled at him, "Here's the key, get out of my face."
Yeah, I don't know why, but I don't believe any of that.
Who would believe Sharon? Because if it was true, if this was all true, why wouldn't she have just called the police? And if she were so innocent, she would have not gone through the trouble of making sure she had an alibi the night of the murder, November 18th of 1988. So on this night, she took her children and invited herself over to a neighbor's house, and she was there for hours. And usually, when there would be a dusting of snow on the ground, Sharon would be the first one out the door. You know, she lived in Colorado, near the mountains. She never got used to driving in the snow. Well, that night, there were layers of snow piled on top of each other, and Sharon didn't care. Then, at 9 o'clock at night, she left as suddenly as she arrived. So during this time, miles north of the Roundhouse neighborhood, Gary was up to no good. He was following the map that Sharon drew for him so that he could find the house on Columbine Court. And it was at 8:30 p.m. He was standing in front of the brick ranch home. The plan was to hit Glenn in the head and then he would burn the body. He had hidden in his belt line and rubbing against his rib cage an 18-inch lead pipe he had planned to use to hit Glenn on top of the head. But in case that didn't work, he also brought a .22 caliber handgun. He had the key. He slid it into the lock, opened the door. However, Glenn was not there. But this was all a part of the plan. He already knew the layout of the house. His dream woman, aka Cher, had already described every room. He made his way to the end of the hall where the master bedroom was located. There he found the dresser where the wedding ring band lay. He put the ring in his pocket. He was not going to disappoint his lover. He wanted to do everything for her. So as Gary prepared for Glenn to arrive, he remembered Sharon telling him, "He is home no later than 9. He is so predictable, you could set your watch by him." Gary returned to the living room and he sat on the recliner with his lead pipe in his hand and he waited. And he also remembered something else, Sharon told him. She said, "Do this right and we'll make love all night, every night, you and me forever." Seconds turned to minutes and Gary started becoming jittery. He started thinking he couldn't do it. He thought to himself, "Not again, not her." He jumped out of the recliner and he decided that he just wasn't going to do it. Then headlights showed through the window. Glenn was home. It was too late. Gary waited behind the door. He had the pipe ready. The door opened, and Gary swung the lead pipe at Glenn's head. Glenn fell to the floor. But just like what Gary experienced when he murdered Dr. Perry Nelson, Glenn was not unconscious. He got right up to fight. He was fighting for survival at this point, just like how Dr. Nelson tried to fight for his survival. Gary hit Glenn with the pipe again, but Glenn didn't get knocked out. Instead, Glenn started fighting. He flipped Gary onto his back. And Gary knew he had to use his backup, so he took out his .22 caliber gun and fired it two times. Just like that, Glenn was dead. Now, initially, Gary, he wanted to use the lead pipe because he knew that he could at least make it look like some kind of accident. But two gunshot wounds to the head would never look like an accident. With some quick thinking, he decided to make the scene look like a botched robbery. He threw some clothes around the room to make it look like the room was ransacked. Sharon had also told him about the grates, which were over the basement. Those grates could be removed and someone can come through the windows. He removed the grates and then he brought a chair and stood it against the window to make it look like someone had crawled into the house through the basement windows. But Gary didn't realize that there was a flaw in his plans. The grates that were removed from the basement window could only be removed from the inside. There would be no way someone could crawl into the basement from the outside. So someone would have had to have been inside the house to remove the grates. But Gary, he wasn't finished with staging the scene. He scattered coins from a coin jar that he found in the closet. And as far as the plan, which included burning the body, Sharon had told him beforehand that Glenn kept gasoline in the garage. So he took the gasoline from the garage, spilled it all over Glenn's body and the area around his body. Then he struck a match. And when he struck a match, he realized that he needed to delay the fuse a bit. So instead of throwing the match into the gas puddle, he lit a cigarette and he placed the cigarette inside a book of matches. This method would at least give him an extra 5 minutes to get to safety. And at this point, Gary, he wasn't thinking about how this murder would hurt other people. All he cared about was saving his own life, and he's thinking about Sharon. So within a few minutes, he sat in his truck waiting for the sirens. He wanted to make sure that someone had called the fire department. But 5 minutes turned into 10 minutes, and nothing happened. And so Gary returned to the home and he opened the garage door. Black smoke is just pouring out and he didn't want to stay for a second longer, so he ran out.
Wasn't Glenn a firefighter?
He was. And what makes this story interesting is the firefighters, they eventually show up at the house. They all know Glenn. They all worked with him and they were all friends with him. They knew Glenn was a competent firefighter, and there's just no way that a firefighter as good as Glenn would be killed by a fire in his own house. And police officials had no trouble finding their prime suspect, because when Thornton police detectives Elaine Tygart and Glenn Traynor traveled all the way to the roundhouse to deliver the news to the second Mrs. Glenn Harrelson, they could tell that the wife was hiding something. So they asked her to come down to the police station the next day. And on November 20th of 1988, 2 days after Glenn's murder, police arrested Gary and Sharon. They were charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder, conspiracy, and solicitation to commit first-degree murder. Both Gary and Sharon also pled guilty to both murders because they wanted to avoid the death penalty. Also, as part of her plea deal, Sharon admitted to the officers her role in the murders. She also told the police she paid Gary $50,000 for his role in killing Dr. Nelson. And you know what's strange about this confession? Sharon did not admit that she knew anything about the murder until the officers took her to Pizza Hut. She told them she thought people were listening to her through the walls.
She must have really liked Pizza Hut to already be confessing.
I like Pizza Hut too.
Me too.
So Gary Harrelson, who was deeply involved with Sharon Nelson in the murders of her husbands, believed that these murders were necessary, and he went along with her plans out of his obsessive love for her. He received life in prison without the possibility of parole. And as for Sharon Nelson, convicted of first-degree murder for the deaths of her second and third husbands, pleaded guilty. However, she later filed a federal habeas corpus petition. She argued that her plea was not made knowingly and voluntarily, claiming that she was under severe emotional distress and duress at the time. But this was ultimately denied. So she was serving two consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. However, Sharon, who was in her early 70s, passed away in prison in 2017. And so, this is how the story ends. Whether Sharon was driven by the lure of a hefty insurance payout or simply relished the twisted satisfaction of controlling Gary, watching him bend over backwards at her every request, one truth remains. She orchestrated the deaths of two men with Gary as her puppet. And in the end, the man who was completely head over heels for this woman, who was completely manipulated by Sharon, who loved her so blindly, who would have done anything for her, became the scapegoat. It was Gary who bore the weight of all of the blame, as if this deadly game had been his idea all along. And this completes the very twisted story of the woman who made a name for herself, the Black Widow murderer. Be sure to subscribe wherever you're listening, and also tell a friend about Crime Salad.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.